Discretionary listener participation is advised for the following pro wrestling podcast.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Stick to Wrestling. My name is John McAdam. This is the Stick to Wrestling podcast, where if you give us 60 minutes, perhaps indeed we'll give you a wicked good and raw bone podcast. Stick to Wrestling is a classic pro wrestling podcast that mostly focuses on wrestling from the 70s, 80s, and 90s. I say that just about every week, and just about every week we have a show on from the 80s. But yeah, it's all good. Thanks very much for listening. Before I get rolling, if you want to follow me on Twitter, just search the name John McAdam and follow the guy who has the Stick to Wrestling logo as his avatar. You want to join our Facebook group. It's free and it's fun. Lots of good wrestling talk, lots of pictures, results. We'll talk baseball and football every now and then as well. A bunch of really good guys that I'm grateful for. And, this is part three of three of the World Wrestling Federation during the month of March 1984, Steve Generelli and I do a very thorough review, lots of cool audio, so let's get rolling with that. Here's the show. Steve, thank you for doing this with me. I read one of your Observer letters from 1991 today.
Oh, my God. Was it good or was
it
embarrassing? It
was not embarrassing at all. You were talking about SummerSlam 1991, where, I mean, as we're recording this, we're nearing the 30th anniversary of... By the time this comes out, I will have spoken about this on Stick to Wrestling, but I had the opportunity for free tickets to SummerSlam, and I would have gone with Dave Meltzer, John Arezzi, and Wade Keller, and I just couldn't do it. I had to leave. I would have gotten a tour of the After Magazine factory, but the guy I went with and I both absolutely had to work the next day.
Well, I can only imagine you at the After Magazine factory. I think you'd be leaving with a handful of 1969 issues.
I think I'd be throwing everyone else out and just capturing it. Oh, man. I mean, and those magazines were such a big part of the time that we're talking about because, I mean, yes, the After Magazine, all the magazines were at odds with the WWF, but they still covered them. Of course they did.
Yeah, it's like something I said, I think, on the last week's show a couple weeks ago. You know, I was just so starved for real information. I mean, I'd been reading the After magazines for roughly about 7 years, and I knew that they weren't even scratching the surface of real wrestling news. I mean, I was, you know, if I saw the AWA and they were bragging that they were the biggest company in wrestling and the most successful, and yet I could tell that their houses were dwindling and the WWF was doing their thing and Jim Crockett was doing their thing. I just wanted to get some facts, and it took me another 2-3 years before I found the Observer. But, as we keep saying every week, that was the game changer. That's when we actually started to get some real information.
I didn't think anything like the Observer existed. It was absolutely crazy.
Yeah. And I mean, Dave Meltzer, I mean, whether you love him or hate him, I mean, he wrote it in such a professional manner. I mean, Even the editor of the National, Frank DeFord, I mean, he said that Dave Meltzer was the top sports journalist in the country, and I don't think he was embellishing. I mean, I think he was probably correct. I mean, who else was putting out 10 to 12 page output every week of not only fact, but incredible recap, incredible history?
Oh, I mean, I think anyone who hates Meltzer is a kook. I mean, really, if you enjoy learning about wrestling history, I mean, you absolutely have him to thank. If you enjoy listening to this podcast, I mean, a lot of the information I got came directly from Dave.
Yeah, I don't think it would have any knowledge of wrestling history without Dave Meltzer, for sure.
No, he's the guy for that. Hey, one thing I need to do more often is thank the guys at the history of WWE.com, Randy, Richard Land, and Graham Cawthon. I mean, I have a lot to thank them for as far as doing this show. I mean, they have all the results, and it just makes things a lot easier. So, guys, thank you very much. You are appreciated. I also want to thank Keith Barbero, who doesn't even know this show exists yet. He provided a YouTube link for a Piper's Pit that took place with Jimmy Snuka. No, not that Piper's Pit, but one that preceded it. Here we go with that.
I don't know a whole lot about you. I haven't had that much of an interest, but you're from where?
Fiji Islands.
From the Fiji Islands. From the Fiji Islands. That's where they have Fiji Islands. That's where they have those big trees with coconut stuff, right? And your folks went up and down for coconuts like monkeys and stuff like that. Is that the place I'm talking about? No, what I'm trying to say to you, I don't know anything about, hey, don't get me wrong now, I don't know anything about the Fiji Islands. They must have lots of nice, they got big women. I know they got big women there in the Fiji Islands.
They got nice women.
Oh, I'm sure they got nice women. Nothing nice long hair under their armpits. Just a little joke there, just a little joke, fella. Fiji Islands, huh? Fiji Islands. You were born in the Fiji Islands?
Born and raised.
What do you eat in the Fiji Islands? What would you do in the Fiji Islands for fun?
Eating fish.
For fun, you eat fish. That's great. You eat fish for fun. I understand in the Fiji Islands, one of the things you do in the Fiji Islands, what they do is they have the coconuts on the top of the tree, and what you do is you climb up the tree with the coconuts, and you shake the tree. You shake the tree, and the coconuts fall down right on the women's head. Boom, it's kind of handy, though. Splits the coconuts open, kind of makes them with the women a little backwards, makes the kid a little backwards, but nevertheless, it's really handy for the coconuts. What I'm trying to say to you is because you come from the Fiji Islands, and you're telling me how nice the Fiji Islands are, what are you doing here?
Can I just tell you something? Are you trying to put my race and my...
No. By no means. I'm not trying to put your race out. I'm just asking you, what are you doing here?
Excuse me.
No, wait. You're taking this all wrong. I don't know nothing about the Fiji Islands, and you obviously know nothing about Piper's Pit. So that kind of makes... me a little superior to you. What I'm trying to say to you is, you're here, you have a whole bunch of people... What does this mean? Let me ask you something. Am I going over your head? What does this mean?
This means I love you. That's what it means.
Okay, once again on this podcast, all audio is for review purposes only. Steve, I laughed out loud as soon as Piper said, "What do you do for fun?" And Snooki goes, "We eat fish." Even before Piper jumped on it, I was doubled over laughing.
Yeah, I mean, I know some people that do that for fun, but very few. I mean, the two of them really, I mean, they had a unique chemistry. I mean, Piper is just such a bully and such a loudmouth, and Snooki here is playing kind of this, genuine, quiet guy who does these superhuman things in the ring, and it's quite a contrast, but this was quite different than the famous Piper's Pit with the two of them.
Yeah, that was, as a matter of fact, I had seen this on YouTube for the first time ever this week, and in the famous Piper's Pit, Roddy's like, I had you on before, you wouldn't say nothing, and I'm like, when was he on? But I had never seen this one.
So I guess actually he acknowledges this Piper's Pit, which I think neither one of us had ever seen before.
No, I don't know if it was like on All-Star Wrestling or just didn't air or what, but there was a moment in there, if you listen carefully, Piper apologizes to Jimmy Snuka like really quick. Oh, sorry. He accidentally hit him in the face with the microphone. Not hard, but enough. So you say, oh, man, sorry about that.
Yeah, well, they hadn't really started their blood feud yet, so he'd be a little bit polite, I guess, there in the moment.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was just weird to see him break character for even that nanosecond that he did. It was kind of cool.
Yeah. Well, these guys really would take the WWF in a really kind of a different direction. I mean, most WWF feuds, I mean, historically had always been like, bad guy beats the good guy, a couple of inconclusive decisions, and then in the end, the good guy prevails. When we get to the Piper Snuka feud, it really kind of felt like the very first time a good guy lost out in the end and the bad guy prevailed.
The first one I can think of that I was old enough to witness might have been Superstar Billy Graham against Bruno Sammartino.
Yeah, I mean, you could definitely look at it that way as far as, he did prevail and he won the championship and he didn't lose it back to Bruno. That's actually a really good catch on that, John. You and I know the real reason why Bruno didn't prevail. He really wanted out. But, in a kayfabe sense, you're right. Billy did win that feud.
You know what? Two more, and the same guy lost out. Morocco against Rocky Johnson in 1983, and Piper against Rocky Johnson in 1984. But everything I'm saying kind of proves your point. Like, it's really an exception in the old WWF when the babyface did not come out on top. You know, I mean, I just came up with like three or four exceptions over a period of like 8 years.
Yeah. And I mean, I think the one with Bruno, I mean, that's kind of almost like, well, he had to lose because he was leaving the company, basically. But the rest of them, yeah, they were definitely showing you that wrestling was going to go in a different direction. It wasn't just like the old school way of, okay, this bad guy is going to lose because he's going to go away. And, you know, now Piper's not going to lose because he's going to stick around and hopefully wrestle another 3 or 4 years. You know, as fate would have it, Piper didn't stay another 3 or 4 years, maybe 3 years, but, you know, he had a lot of breaks in between. But he was so valuable to the company, there was no way they'd want to get rid of him or not have him be a part of the roster.
Yeah, another one I just thought of was Greg Valentine against Chief J. Strongbow in 79. Most of their matches went to like a double disqualification, like even the Indian strap matches. And that one didn't make a lot of sense to me because, well, they both kind of went away after that. But why not just have Valentine do the honors?
I always kind of assumed that Strongbow ended up winning maybe their final matches, but maybe as you just said, maybe it's more like that didn't happen since they were both on the way out. I know after that feud was done, Strongbow moved along, and I think Valentine pretty much left the territory, so...
No, you're exactly right. They were both gone after that feud. Valentine went back to the Carolinas, and Strongbow went home. I kind of thought he retired. He... was out of the magazines for like 2-3 years until he came back in 82. Well, but anyway, let's talk about Championship Wrestling from March 31st, 1984. Tito Santana defeats Mike Powers. I don't remember him. Greg Valentine over Francisco Vasquez. I don't remember him. Bob Backlund defeats Tony Russo. And then we have Paul Orndorff against Santiago Rios, another jobber I don't remember. And then Piper's Pit has a guest, Private Terry Daniels, who will soon become the first inductee in Sergeant Slaughter's Cobra Corps. Let's listen to that.
In a moment, ladies and gentlemen, we'd like to take you to Piper's Pit. Before we do, we'd like to remind you that the views expressed in Piper's Pit, those of Mr. Piper alone and those of his guests, and not necessarily those of us here on the World Wrestling Federation Network. With that in mind, ladies and gentlemen, we take you now to Piper's Pit.
I'm having such a good time this week. All kinds of things are going along. I got this fella here, Terry Daniels. What a snazzy young fella. A nice looking snazzy uniform. I gotta ask you something. Gotta ask you something right off the top of my head. First of all, Terry, it's nice to have you here.
Thank you very much.
I wanna ask you. I see all kinds of movies. I see all kinds of movies where the drill instructor, he's got it. First of all, let me introduce this fella. His name is Terry Daniels. He's from the Forces now, a member with Slaughter of a Cobra Corps. And I've seen these movies. Now, just a second. Listen to this. I've seen these movies where these drill instructors, they come down and they start like, can you hear me? G.I. Joe, G.I. Joe, fighting. Are you, first of all, you wouldn't act this thing, G.I. Joe, and can you hear me, and all that other stuff. I see it in the movies. We got you here in person. You can't tell me sincerely that you're going to stand there and let some geek like that yell in your face, say all this stuff, and not do anything. Surely it's just in the movies, huh?
Yes, sir. It's called mental discipline.
Wait a second. You're telling me yes, they do this to you, or no, they don't? It's only in the movies.
No, sir. They do it. It's called mental discipline.
Do you have a mental problem? Why?
The reason for this is it gives you self-dedication. It helps you prepare for this. If you can handle the yelling and everything, then you can handle anything.
Wait, just a second. This guy, you were trying to tell me if I was a drill instructor, I can get up on you and say all kinds of nasty things about your sister. and you're just going to stand there and take it without any repercussion. Me, myself, I haven't done anything anybody told me my whole life. I didn't bother going in the armed forces like the Marines because, first of all, they couldn't handle someone. Do you think they could handle someone like myself in the Marines?
Yes.
Do you think... Hey, it's opinion. At least you're being honest. What I'm saying to you is you get a guy like Sergeant Slaughter, the drill instructor. Now, just a second. There's a whole bunch of Iranians out there, and they all got rifles shooting at you, and you're hiding under the table. He says, get up, you nothing, and go fight them, and you're going to get shot for sure. Are you going to go?
Yes, sir.
You're nuts.
Just a minute, Mr. Piper. The man, he's got pride. He's an American. He loves what he does. That's just it. If he tells me to do that, I'm going to do it because I'm an American. I love my country, and I'll do whatever it takes to fight for it. That's just it. I'm a Marine. I'm proud to be a Marine, and I'm proud to become a member of the elite force of the Cobra Corps. Thank you, sir.
The Cobra Corps? The Cobra Corps is a bunch of brownies that can't find the campfire. Get off the air. Get the hook out. I'm the boss. Take them off the air, man.
Oh, my goodness. Back up to action now in the ring.
My favorite, maybe not my favorite part, but I always love the disclaimer before Piper's Pit from Vince McMahon, distancing the WWF from the views of Roddy Piper.
I thought this was one of the best ones we've heard so far. I mean, what really stood out to me listening to this with Terry Daniels is just how simple it was and just the idea. I mean, Piper's the bully. He's talking to this young guy who's very kind of new to wrestling, and he's obviously kind of the protege of Sergeant Slaughter, and he's talking about, you know, being a Marine and, you know, following the Corps and the philosophy of the Corps, and Piper isn't having any of it. He's insulting this kid and he's making fun of him, but, you know, I found the whole thing, it felt so real and so. You were really engaged and caught up into it. And I was just thinking, it made me think about today's wrestling. And it's like, today's wrestling is so far removed. It's like, they never would do anything that would really involve a real life thing. Like, well, yeah, some young people go into the military. In fact, they have ads for going into the Marines on the wrestling show. I see all the time. But this seems so real, but what's going on in wrestling today, we don't want to go off on a tangent, but I did find this skit really real believable and exciting.
It's right in my notes right here. One of the best pits. I mean, it's like you said, Piper just shows up and starts bullying this young guy. And in the video, like, Piper's right in his face screaming, and Terry Daniels completely keeps his cool.
Yeah, and you know, and now we're the year is 2021, and we're in the, you know, the most popular thing on earth seems to be the Marvel Comics universe, and you have you know, superheroes with their sidekicks who are maybe not as strong, and the whole idea of having Sergeant Slaughter, who was one of the very top wrestlers of the time, right up with Hulk Hogan, the fact that he would have this protege who was just a young up and coming guy who is. You know, didn't have any of the attributes of Sergeant Slaughter other than the love of the USA. It was interesting to see that kind of a vulnerability of this young guy, and that was something that they definitely used for a little while. And I think they could have probably gone longer with that whole gimmick of having a major star like Slaughter have a sidekick who was young and vulnerable and could have been taken advantage more by the heels.
I thought they should have booked Terry Daniels maybe not even a little stronger, a lot stronger, like certainly the you know, the Robin and the Batman relationship. But I thought, you know, being Sergeant Slaughter's protege, he's the, you know, the only member of the Cobra Corps, which sounds pretty cool. I just didn't think they gave him enough juice in the end.
Yeah, it just seemed like the whole thing kind of fizzled out. But you know, after some of the angles we've seen subsequently, I mean, it could have been interesting to maybe turn him into a heel, have him become a you know, Iraqi sympathizer. I mean, they could have gone a whole, you know, 20 different ways with the angle, but they just never did. They just kind of let him fade out and be forgotten in the history of the WWE.
Yeah, very forgotten. I mean, I'll tell you what, if they had turned him into an Iranian sympathizer, I would legitimately be fearful for his health, even knowing. Have you heard the Terry Daniels story?
No.
Okay, and multiple sources have confirmed this. Back in the old Amarillo territory, they did the tough man thing where if you get in the ring with Adrian Adonis and you can beat him, you win like $500 or something. It was like the mid-70s. Mm-hmm. And of course, Adrian Adonis, you know, not just being a legit wrestler, but being a legit street fighter, would mop the floor with everybody. Mm-hmm. So one week they get this guy, he's not particularly big, and he takes on Adrian Adonis. They have the wildest brawl ever. And it was a legit brawl. And, you know, again, it was Terry Daniels, not a big guy. And they have they book a rematch for the next week. And everyone's talking about it. And they Adonis gets in the ring with this guy who's not working. And they suddenly announce that Dick Murdoch is the referee. And Murdoch was not going to allow any punching from Daniels, who was a gold glove boxer as well as a legitimate former Marine. So in a wrestling contest, Adonis took care of him. And then I think it was Dory Funk Jr. or Dick Murdoch, maybe both, that approached Terry Daniels about getting into pro wrestling. But if you can hold your own against a young Adrian Adonis, look out for that guy.
Definitely. And he, you know, you and I were talking off camera about, wrestling comparables or, you know, wrestlers who are similar to other wrestlers. Terry Daniels could have been like another Jake Milliman type, I think. No neck, small, but definitely lots of fire and very hard to beat.
Yeah, he had kind of a weird career. They did an angle in Mid-South where the Dirty White Boys desecrated his Marine uniform, and Sergeant Slaughter wound up wrestling one night there. At least he was supposed to. Then he went to like Southwest / USA Championship Wrestling, and that was kind of the last we heard of him. He, you know, from this moment, he's got maybe 2 years left in his career.
He was kind of like Don Carnotto as far as somebody who was just in the WWF for a cup of coffee and, you know, could have been used better, but it just wasn't meant to be for him to have a major push, I guess.
No, and like I said, I think they should have done more with him, and if they didn't think they could do more with Terry Daniels, they should have gotten someone else for the spot. But how many legit former Marines do we have out there? Certainly not Sergeant Slaughter.
Right, right. And you know, when Sergeant Slaughter left, they tried with Corporal Kirshner to play a similar role, and that didn't fare too well either. So,
oh, that flopped spectacularly. And I thought that gimmick had a little bit of potential because Vietnam War movies were all the thing in the mid-80s. But like you said, I thought it was too obvious that they were copying Sergeant Slaughter. Anyway, Bob Orton Jr. defeats Lee Wong, who had been with the WWF since the mid-70s, meaning Wong, of course. Roddy Piper defeats SD Jones in what was a competitive match. And then we have Ivan Putski defeating Frank Williams, who had been around since I started watching in 1976, and we'll be seeing he's not going to be around much longer.
Well, I think what's worth noting here is the return of Bob Orton after probably a 2 year absence or so. He would end up being somebody who would be one of the top stars, or at least upper middle top stars for the next 3 or 4 years, especially as Piper's bodyguard and featured at WrestleMania 1 in the finish of the main event. Bob Orton to me was always a guy that was just so underrated as far as what he could do in the ring, and he made everything look so easy and effortless.
He was a natural, and good catch. I did not realize this was his return. He came back after leaving right around the end of 1982, so we're still kind of familiar with him. He had the big push in Mid-Atlantic when he turned on Ric Flair and collected the bounty. He and Dick Slater collected the bounty Harley Race put on Ric Flair.
Yeah, Dick Slater and Orton to me would be a great team. In fact, Slater's WWF run was so much of a kind of a failure. I kind of wish that they had paired those two together at some point.
Now, Slater's run in the WWF was abysmal, especially considering that he was the top guy in Mid-South Wrestling before that happened. I mean, I don't know what it was. I mean, I've made a joke in the past. Like, Steve, do you remember the old Batman reruns?
Of course. I watched all of them.
Okay, yeah, so did I, multiple times. And they had one where usually they were two-parters, but this is a one-parter. Trust me, folks, this is wrestling-related, where the Joker kidnaps a surfer, and he has this machine where he steals all of this guy's surfing ability.
I remember it well, yes.
Okay, someone hooked Dick Slater up to that machine and stole all of his charisma. Because the fire was out, and it was out for good once he left Mid-South.
Yeah, I mean, I would say to be kind of giving to Slater, I think he caught a little bit of it back, that maybe that last run he had with WCW, maybe just a little bit around 88, 89, around the time that Funk was in 89. You know, he showed a little bit of life, but you're right. I mean, he could no longer be like considered one of the top guys like he had been in the early 80s to mid 80s with Mid-South.
You know, I respectfully disagree with you. I was actually very happy when the NWA brought Dick Slater in 1989. And then just within a few weeks, I'm like, I'm watching Dick Slater's corpse out here. This was not a WWF problem. I mean, just, you know, everything got sucked out of him, and which is too bad. I was a big fan of early 80s, late 70s Dick Slater. I thought he could have been NWA champion.
Yeah, he's one guy that he probably deserves a book on his career. He's very unique guy and a very interesting story. I mean, at one point, I think he was very favorably thought of as a potential future NWA champion. If you're looking around, maybe in the late 70s, he had some kind of a major accident of some sort where I think he actually did have some kind of major brain damage of some sort, and people in the business always said that he was never quite the same after that. I mean, he had a big runs after that, but I think it affected him in some way. And
I did not know about that. Wow.
Yeah. It was some major life changing event. I don't know if it was an auto accident or something major like that, but it affected him. And you know, his wrestling career probably ended, I'm assuming, probably around 1990 or so. And then, you know, I think he did a shoot interview, and then he, in the 2000s, he got very ill and had his last few years, which was very brutal from what I heard. But I think a lot of fans, especially in Florida and NWA territories, look back very fondly at Dick Slater.
Very much so. There's a story about Dick Slater that, I mean, everyone in Florida has heard this story. He's in high school, and, you know, he's not supposed to go into a strip joint, but he's going. And John Matuszak is working the door in Tampa, and Dick Slater's like, you know, I'm not letting this guy get in his way. And supposedly Slater just slaughtered John Matuszak.
Yeah, that's a real famous story. And, and there are a lot of Tampa tough guys. I mean, Orndorff and Slater were two of probably the most talked about Tampa tough guys.
For sure. All right. We have some more audio from the upcoming Boston Garden Show, which is going to be April 14th, 1984. Headlined by Sergeant Slaughter versus the Iron Sheik. Let's go to that now.
Peruse this great card, slated for the Boston Garden Saturday night, April the 14th, and I've just got to be impressed by the fantastic efforts of promoters here in the great state of Massachusetts. Salvatore Bellomo to meet Charlie Fulton, Putski going against Goulet, Blair and Valentine to do battle. Ladies tag team action, world tag team action, Atlas Johnson colliding with Piper and Schultz, Tito Santana to be challenged for the Intercontinental title by Tiger Chung Lee. Mr. Wonderful, Paul Orndorff, to meet the great Bob Backlund and Iron Sheik, Freddie Blassie, Ayatollah Blassie. Come on in. Gentlemen, the match they're talking about all over the wrestling world. Sergeant Slaughter to meet you, sir.
Sergeant Slaughter, I hope in the Boston, Massachusetts people have enough education to go in the library, read about the Iron Sheik, Khosrow Waziri, his background. Look at from Olympic 60 at Mexico City to 84 Los Angeles. I just want to know, soldier, what you done to your country? Now, in the Boston, Massachusetts, I have not a thing in my mind. What do you want to ask me?
What's with all this hardware here that you're wearing?
Don't worry about it. I just want to show that all American people in the Boston, who is the real champion? A Sergeant Slaughter or the Iron Sheik? I know it's your country in the Boston. I know you have a lot of support. I hope you people have enough money to make it that night. Make enough money putting the gas in your car so you come that night. I'm already excited. Sergeant Slaughter, American Federation is a prejudice that brings the Marine men for the Iron Sheik. Now, in the Boston, Massachusetts, swear to Ayatollah Khomeini. One more time.
Thank you very much, Iron Sheik. Sergeant Slaughter, collide in the Boston Garden, Saturday night, April the 14th.
Hey.
I like Gene talking about the promoters in the great state of Massachusetts, plural. Iron Sheik, what a great interview he was.
No, he was, and he really... He always had a great chemistry with Mean Gene. I don't know if it was their familiarity with each other from the AWA days, but he would always, the Cosgrove would always say something to him like, "You're intelligent Jewish businessman." Or something. It was just funny the kind of their give and take they would have with each other.
Yeah, I have two Iron Sheik stories, one of which I will never tell in a public forum, but the second one, I saw him in, I think in Baltimore, yeah, it was Baltimore in 1989, and I was talking to him a little bit the night before, and he sees me the next day, and it was like he was doing a pro wrestling promo, but not realizing. He's like, "Shoddy Hamuck! I saw you last night!" And you're like, "Don't piss yourself, pal. It's cool." But just a great interview. I also should correct myself a little bit that Sergeant Slaughter versus Iron Sheik was probably the main event, but it might be more accurate to say it was a co-main event with Bob Backlund and Paul Orndorff, like co-main eventing with Sheik and Slaughter.
Yeah. I mean, I can see that's how they build it. But I mean, from a fan standpoint, definitely, Sheik versus Slaughter was the hot ticket at the time. That was really the premier issue going on in the WWF at that point. Hogan wasn't really in a major blood feud with anybody. Piper really hadn't started his thing with Snuka yet. And obviously, there was no real major issue between Orndorff and Backlund. So I think that the feud between, or the match between Sheik and Slaughter was what really sold the tickets.
I agree with you. Although this was back during a time, and this time ended a long time ago, like within 2 years this would be gone, where you would go to the wrestling matches and you would see Bob Backlund versus Paul Orndorff. You'd look forward to it, and it was just a match. It's like, okay, these are two of the top five guys in the WWF, right around there. Who's going to win? I'm seeing, it's like college football, seeing number four against number six or something like that. Yeah, it's just a game. Championship's not on the line, but there are implications from the result.
Oh, yeah. And again, we've talked about this in some of our recent programs. Backlund was kind of in this weird area, still getting a push somewhat, still talked about on the TV. But he was obviously starting to get phased out. And here he is facing Orndorff, who's going to be one of the top guys. And Orndorff is kept strong, and they're going to push him to the moon over the next 2 to 3 years. But Backlund is just kind of like, once he lost the title, he was like on an island somewhere.
I think it was more like once Hogan won the title, it's like, okay, what's the next step for Bob Backlund? I mean, maybe he could be this generation's Pedro Morales or Ivan Putski, just a top guy who, Morales had a couple of programs. I don't think Putski ever really had. Nah, he didn't have one prior to this, I don't think. I can't think of one. But they're there, and they're big stars, and there's a place for them. But as the year went on, things started to go really sideways for Bob Backlund, and we'll talk more about that when we get to the April 14th Boston Garden show. All-Star Wrestling has Tito Santana defeating Tony Russo, Dr. D. David Schultz over Francisco Vasquez, Greg Valentine over Boston's own Rudy Diamond, Paul Orndorff over Santiago Rios. Then we get some reruns, Terry Daniels on the pit, Orton versus Lee Wong, Roddy Piper against Dusty Jones, and Ivan Putski against Johnny Ringo. This is, once again, a very slow hour of television for the WWF.
Yeah, and just getting back to Backlund just for a moment, I think the biggest thing that happened with him, the WWF in this time frame is pushing these larger-than-life personalities. You know, Sergeant Slaughter went from being this super hated guy to being this super beloved guy. You have Orndorff, who's this egomaniac villain. You know, Hogan, the all-American good guy. I mean, all the guys who are getting the big pushes have these larger-than-life personalities. And Backlund has really no personality. He just tries to be a humble, bland, regular guy, and there's really no room for that. I mean, how can you promote that compared to all these other guys who are like five times the size of any comic book character?
No, long term, and I didn't realize it at the time, that was not going to work. I mean, if I had a nickel for every time I said this, Bob Backlund was going in one direction, and the wrestling business was going in a different direction where there is a lot more showmanship, and Bob was not a showman.
Yeah, he could entertain you with his physical ability, like through the telling of a story of a wrestling match, but you know, they weren't pushing those types of matches anymore. And it's kind of sad, but it just is the progress. You know, it's the way things change.
All right. Wrestling at the Chase, January 31st, 1984, has Tito Santana defeating Alexis Smirnoff. Steve, one thing I've always been big on is if you're going to have a guy doing jobs on TV, don't give him a gimmick. And now we've got Alexis Smirnoff. To me, it's hard to push your next Russian, killer Russian heel when you've got another guy like that doing jobs on TV. And I don't think the WWF really ever had one. Maybe Nikolai Volkov, but like I'll use him for an example. Like to me, having Smirnoff losing on TV in full Russian gimmick kind of waters down Nikolai Volkov.
No, well, that's true, and but you know, I guess to play devil's advocate, I mean, Volkov wasn't really back on the roster quite yet. They use this, you know, Russian, Smirnoff. You and I knew from the magazines he had been wrestling for many, many years, maybe 10 years or so, or even more. He was a veteran star, was well known on the West Coast. I didn't have any problem with it. I mean, I kind of probably felt like, you know, he's such a, you know, well-known name within wrestling that he should have been more than just the TV jobber that he was doing these jobs on these shows. But, you know, that's what they had for him. They didn't really want to give him a push. And maybe they knew that Volkov would eventually be coming back and that he would be their in-house Russian, so to speak.
Yeah, you kind of needed one of those in 1984, the political climate being what it was. Okay, let me see. What else do we have? Tony Atlas and Rocky Johnson defeat Charlie Fulton and Butcher Vachon. Hulk Hogan defeats Tiger Chung Lee. And Big John Studd defeats Jose Luis Rivera. Anything you want to speak about on the St. Louis show?
Well, the only thing I want to add to this, the night before, and I found this interesting, the night before, the St. Louis Wrestling Office had a show, which is just interesting to make note of. Now, listen to this roster, this lineup, and take a look at some of their ages involved. We had Harley Race, who was the Missouri State champion at the time, defeated Wahoo McDaniel. Butch Reed and the Blackjacks defeated Crusher Blackwell, Ken Patera, and Luke Graham. Jimmy Garvin defeated... Sorry, my page just jumped. Jimmy Garvin defeated Chris Adams. Dick the Bruiser defeated Scott Earthquake Ferris. One Man Gang defeated Hacksaw Duggan via DQ. Dick Slater defeated Buzz Tyler. The Fabulous Ones defeated TJ Stone and Pat Kelly. And lastly, the Grapplers defeated Ted Oates and Les Thornton. And so you have guys on the card like the Blackjacks, Luke Graham, Dick the Bruiser, you know, Harley and Wahoo. I mean, Harley definitely had some mileage left in him. But you can tell that, you know, it's a different approach. It's a different much more old school lineup than what the WWF was putting forth in the same city the following night.
Yeah, it was definitely different. I also think it's interesting that they brought up the Chris Adams versus Jimmy Garvin feud from Dallas.
Yeah, that is very interesting. I mean, they had some really good young performers there that would eventually become WWF superstars years later. But it was just a time where you can look at these promotions who are fighting this war, the so-called war against the WWF, and they were just relying too much on too much veteran talent.
St. Louis was always an odd city. I mean, I would have loved to have gone to a St. Louis show, or maybe even grown up around there so I could see the wrestling, but they were always using older guys. Like in the late 70s, we're talking guys like Pat O'Connor or Gene Kaniski. I mean, they're using Blackjack Lanza now. I mean, wow.
But what I liked about that approach, I guess, in the old days when Mushnick was promoting, like, I guess, 1981 and prior, he had a heavy sports emphasis. He didn't have many gimmicks. I think, he used Bobby Heenan like one time as a manager. He didn't use managers. I mean, he really pushed wrestling as a legitimate sport. And when you watch some of those old Wrestling at the Chase shows with a very young Kevin Von Erich or young DiBiase, as they used to say.
That's right.
It's really refreshing to see all this young talent and mixed in with the old guys like the Dick the Bruisers and the Kaniskis. I mean, yeah, you're absolutely right. I think they relied on those veteran guys much too much. But, part of it, with, I think O'Connor was one of the owners of the promotion. And, what are you going to do? But it just this is what really intrigues me a lot about this time period. WWF is going with all the best, youngest talent. And a lot of their opposition is going with the guys who, aren't necessarily the youngest, but a lot of famous wrestlers. And you're seeing a lot of guys put to work here in this time frame.
Yeah, it was definitely an interesting town, and they must have gotten world-class wrestling on a UHF station or something to bring up that match. And again, that just shows you how much wrestling was changing. Like, world-class was on in 1983 in Boston. It sounds like it was on in St. Louis, too. And, like I said, just the changing face of the industry.
What was your, after growing up on WWF since, like, 76 when you first saw it, I mean, what was your first impression when you saw, like, world-class wrestling?
It was night and day, and it was on at the exact same time as WWF Championship Wrestling. Like, why did these both have to be on 11 o'clock Saturday? But it blew the WWF away. It wasn't just the that they had a young roster, that they had a much faster moving product in the ring. World Class was not shy about showing main events on TV every single week. It was such a different world. And what do you know? It still draws. Like, there's that old wrestling adage where if you give fans too much on TV, they won't come out. And that has been proven completely false. And World Class led the way with that.
No, absolutely. And one thing I'll just add to this is the first time I had ever seen World Class, I think we had just gotten some cable channels. And one of the cable channels was the Christian Broadcasting Network, which was a Pat Robertson-owned station.
Yeah.
And they did have wrestling on there. I don't think it was really on that long, but it was a show that had some outdoor matches. I don't think it was from Dallas Stadium, but I do remember Bugsy McGraw wrestling on it, and I had remembered him from being in WWF maybe 4 or 5 years prior. And it just didn't really do anything for me watching it. I mean, I could tell they were good athletes and it was exciting in a certain way, but I think what really captivated me maybe about WWF was just like the managers and all the drama and action going on and just the larger than life personalities. And and now as Vince is taking his father's promotion national, he's really concentrating on that. I mean, the guys like the Hogan and Albano and Blassie and Slaughter and all these huge personalities he's pushing to the moon. And maybe he doesn't have the best wrestling in the world compared to the other promotions, but personality wise, he's like head and shoulders above the rest.
I can definitely see that. I don't think I would have gotten into wrestling had it not been for Blassie Albano and the Grand Wizard and all the crazy characters that they brought in. I mean, it certainly stood out.
Yeah, I mean, I know you've talked about times you've been to the matches, and you know, occasionally I think you said that one of the matches you attended live was like Bob Orton against Bob Backlund, and the fans gave him a standing ovation because it was just such an incredible match. But you know, those types of matches are kind of few and far between. But you know, the interviews that you see each week and just the crazy antics, you really get caught up in that, and you miss it if you don't see it.
No, and the bottom line is it worked. I mean, the WWF consistently drew, certainly from the time I started watching in 76 all the way into the Hulk Hogan era. Let me see. That night, Saturday, March 31st, 1984, we have a big event at the Philadelphia Spectrum. I have seen this show. Salvatore Bellomo defeats Miguel Feliciano in the opener. Steve, you used to go to WWF shows. I mean, the opener was always just so deliberately slow. Nothing happened. They were just waiting for people to get into their seats.
Yeah, I know in those early years, especially when Vince's father was running it, they usually had these just terrible matches with guys who were kind of the bottom of the TV jobbers against each other. And I know you kind of get a kick out of those matches. Me, not so much. But, you know, in defense of Vince Jr., when he took over, I really thought that the quality of the cards picked up massively. I mean, yeah, you might still have one of those stinkeroo type matches to open it up, but he got more name wrestlers, name value wrestlers, and pretty soon we were having people like Ken Patera and other big names would be wrestling in the matches rather than just like three good matches with four stinkers. I mean, now we were having like seven matches with maybe five matches with, you know, big names and maybe one or two that didn't have any names that you're familiar with.
Yeah, it was. I mean, we'll get to this later. I mean, I went to the Night of Champions at the New Jersey Meadowlands. I'm used to Bellomo versus Feliciano being the opening event. And on that show, the opener was Jake Roberts against Ronnie Garvin. Like, whoa, that's not what I was used to. Anyway, Terry Daniels defeats Butcher Rashawn. Tito Santana and Greg Valentine go to a 20-minute draw. Paul Orndorff defeats Chief J. Strongbow with a forearm smash. And then they have an interesting match. Sergeant Slaughter versus Dr. D. David Schultz. It goes to a double disqualification. Schultz and Slaughter had their breakup on the previous Spectrum show. So what they're doing, I think, is kind of giving you a little bit of an appetizer. Okay, you've got Slaughter against Schultz in this short but good brawl, and I'm guessing they're going to be back next month. And by the time they get to the show after that, Philadelphia is going to be salivating for Slaughter against the Sheik.
Oh, yeah. And in much like yourself, I happen to catch this card as well. It's on. It's actually on YouTube if anybody wants to catch it. For whoever put it on YouTube, I don't know what happened, but the audio is like 30 seconds behind what you're going to see on the screen. But
yeah,
it made it a little bit difficult to watch. But yeah, it was interesting to watch these matches because I noticed with the match between Strongbow and Orndorff, it seemed like the fans were noticeably booing Strongbow. You know, we talked about him being phased out, but it was really almost sad to see him in the corner, like looking at the fans and they're kind of waving him off like, you know, what are you doing out here? You know, you should be retired by now. And Orndorff is, you know, looks like a, you know, all world. He should be wrestling in a really competitive match rather than wrestling old 55-year-old Chief J. Strongbow, but any thoughts from you on the card as well?
Why to this day I have always been a little bit disappointed that Chief J. Strongbow did not get a retirement tour where he got one last win over I don't know who, but you know, maybe Mr. Fuji. There you go. I mean, he was so immensely popular up here when Strongbow died. I heard about his passing
on the classic rock radio station. I mean, that's how big he was up here. And I understand that's not where Vince wanted his focus, but just as a local thing in Boston, New York, Philly, I think would have been a nice gesture.
Well, when they had the famous Legends Battle Royal at the Meadowlands, and he was one of the wrestlers that wrestled, and he was there with, you know, obviously the great Lou Fez and Pat O'Connor and Kaniski and a whole host of others. I think he may have gotten the biggest reaction of anybody since the, you know, this was at the end of 87, and most of those fans had grown up seeing Chief J. Strongbow, whether from the 70s or the early 80s. And he came out, you know, he wore like this huge t-shirt to cover his, you know, gut and his body. But he was dispatched out. He didn't win the Battle Royal. Maybe that would have been the tribute you were kind of looking for, but it was kind of a sad end for Chief J.
No, I agree with you that he just went further and further down the card until he disappeared. But anyway, we got Sergeant Slaughter. We already talked about that. One of the cool things about the Spectrum shows is that Cal Rudman, I didn't think he was a great commentator, but I thought he was a good interviewer. And he would interview the wrestlers backstage, not just talking about their upcoming match, but speaking in general. I enjoyed these. And we have... Here we have him talking to Sergeant Slaughter. Let's go to that.
Cal Rudman's with Sergeant Slaughter in the interview area. Take it away, Cal.
Thank you, Dick Graham. Sergeant Slaughter, I don't understand this. They're cheering for you. They like you. Something's wrong. What's going on?
Well, the people aren't cheering Sergeant Slaughter so much as the American flag and the U.S. of A. I haven't changed a bit. My style's still the same. Still wrestling, rugged and tough, and I'm not yelling at the people because I don't yell at the people. I always yell at my opponents. But as far as the people cheering me, it's a great feeling. I never felt it before in my life. It really helps. I realize now that I maybe was a little bit too rough. I don't know, but it's great.
Well, it's nice to hear you talking into the microphone in a low, calm voice. I used to talk to you about that. You said, no, Cal, that's my style. Now, about your opponent tonight, first of all, it is a grudge match in the great tradition of grudge matches. But you haven't really seen Dr. D. David Schultz wrestle. How are you going to handle this rough, good old boy Southern guy?
Well, you know, the last time we were here at the Spectrum, I went out there just like I normally do, and we had a tag team match against Andre the Giant, Jimmy Snuka, Dr. David Schultz and myself, and we went out there to win the match. We had a great match plan to try to get Snuka away from Andre the Giant, and it ended up that Snuka got the best of David Schultz somehow and got him mad, and he got upset with me somehow, and one thing led to another, and the next thing I know, he ended up punching me, David Schultz did, so I went out after him, and when I came back in, I was ready to fight Andre the Giant, Jimmy Snuka, by myself, and lo and behold, I saw this big ham coming at me from Andre the Giant. He stuck his hand out and said, you know, I think we've had enough. And Jimmy Snuka gave me the I love you sign. And the people, I looked at the people and they said, go ahead. So here I am. And as far as Dr. David Schultz, nobody gets away with cheap shotting Sergeant Slaughter. I might sound a little calm here now, but when I get in that ring, it's a war. And I've got other people on my mind right now by the name of the Iron Sheik and some other people, and David Schultz, if you think you're going to run over me and make me look bad, you're sadly mistaken, because even though I have changed my attitude, I haven't changed my style. I still say yes, I still say ma'am, I like my whiskey on ice and my women on fire, I like a good tasting cigar, and I won't be called a liar.
We'll be right back.
All right, next match is a six-man tag team match with Andre the Giant, Jimmy Snuka, and Tony Garea facing the Wild Samoans and Rene Goulet, who is a sub for Samula. A couple of things, Steve. Number one, 1983 was an endless year of endless Jimmy Snuka versus the Samoans match, and it has bled into March of 1984.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And this particular match was very, very forgettable. I mean, the maybe the only unique thing about it was is that you had the Samoans team up with, of all people, Rene Goulet, who was, I guess, they said a sub for Samoan number three, and Tony Garea teaming with Snuka and Andre. You know, I thought it was interesting because Andre and Goulet, I think, had just teamed together in Japan at one of those big tournaments, MSG tournaments over there. So here they are wrestling against each other. I don't know, maybe they felt that the Samoans could keep Jimmy Snuka under control with his wild behavior outside the ring. But it was your typical match with Andre winning in the end, like he always does, just squashing one of the Samoans so easily.
Yeah, one thing I always noticed about WWF matches, this was a 2 out of 3 fall match, and if they had 2 out of 3 falls or 3 out of 5 falls, like, you'd have a fall sometimes every literally 3 or 4 minutes. They didn't do this time, which is good in a way. The first fall went 15 minutes, the second one went 10 minutes, and the third one went about 5 minutes. So, then again, this may have been a match that didn't merit 30 minutes.
Yeah, this match, I think it just went on way too long. What did you think about the main event, which was surprisingly not Hogan against the Iron Sheik, but Bob Backlund against the Iron Sheik?
Iron Sheik defeats Bob Backlund in 4 minutes and 26 seconds when Hogan takes off his cowboy boots and attacks the Sheik with it. I mean, talk about, I am now the lead babyface, or better yet, the WWF saying he is now the lead babyface, no questions asked. I don't get having Hulk Hogan in the building and using him as Bob Backlund second. I did not get it.
Yeah, I mean, if it was a different world, and if they knew that Backlund was going to renew his push, or they were going to push him as a legend or something like that, then I could see it. But it made very little sense, and it was in some way, I mean, as far as the storyline, maybe it gave a little bit of closure that, you know, Hogan is repaying the favor of Backlund being in his corner and what have you. But by this point, you know, Hogan's the champion. They want to see him wrestle in the main event. They don't want to see Backlund against Iron Sheik, which is kind of a retread from the end of the prior year. Why don't they have Hogan against Iron Sheik? But, you know, I guess that's the beautiful thing about wrestling. Every card is different, and they provide different matches for different audiences.
I was just thinking about that today. I miss the days where every city kind of had its own program and everything was different and the results were interesting. And right around the beginning of 1988, the WWF stopped doing that. They had the same show in every town, and that took some of the enjoyment away for me, quite frankly.
No, I agree 100%. I miss these days when it seemed like every card was somehow unique in its own way, and especially like, I'm not sure how much of the New York programs you got to see, but like from where I lived, I mean, I would watch the New York shows, and you know, they were pushing either the Garden, the Meadowlands, or Nassau Coliseum, or sometimes they're pushing two or three of them all at the same time, and you know, they had to kind of keep you guessing and have unique matchups and surprises and all kinds of things. And they made it interesting and exciting, this time frame we're talking about, especially 84 to 87. But as we got to 88, as we got to 89, it was extremely repetitive, like John just said. I mean, you're going to see the same card, the same matchups in every city in the United States. You're not going to have a weird one-off match or an oddball match. It's just going to be the same program you're going to see, whether you're in Alaska or Wyoming or anywhere in between. It's just going to be the same old thing.
I understand why they did it. I mean, the wrestlers were, you know, sometimes wrestling 9 times a week, and they have to do a promo. They have to do 3 or 4, maybe even 5 promos for every individual city. So that could burn you, you know, to the ground. But it, like I said, I understand the necessity of it, but at the same time, I missed it. I mean, I grew up watching WOR TV in New York at midnight, and also the WWF wrestling from Boston, and they would be advertising 2 completely different shows, which, for one, it doesn't expose the business, and number 2, it makes it more interesting.
Yeah, and when we talk about the time frame you were mentioning where it all went kind of homogenized 1988. The interviews certainly went much more homogenized, as the wrestlers were doing like their own interviews in front of a green screen. They weren't interacting with Mean Gene or Ken Resnick, and those kind of interpersonal interactions, that's what made the local promos so unique, is they would talk about a city or talk about what happened last month. Now it was just a wrestler standing in their green screen in front of their logo and pontificating about something. And sometimes the wrestlers were good enough to pull it off. I mean, Hogan certainly could, Randy Savage could. But, a lot of the guys, it was just so generic and so boring. It was kind of like the beginning of the downhill slide of wrestling until we got to the Attitude Era.
Yes, it was. I mean, I remember summer of 1984 being in Montreal, and of course, we're in the hotel room watching wrestling instead of having fun. And Greg Valentine is up there, is on the screen talking about, Canadian funny money. It's not green like the United States. I got a big kick out of that. And then in 87, Honky Tonk Man would get on the Boston station and start mocking the Boston accent. So you definitely miss that kind of thing.
Yeah, I thought that was always a really cool touch when they would personalize. I can remember even in my own hometown, Binghamton, New York, Spiro Serion was talking about wrestling back then there, and he would say, like, Binghamton, New York, what is that? Where is that? And, it was just hilarious that wrestlers would talk about your city, whether it was the Boston Garden, MSG, or a rinky-dink town like where I was from, Binghamton. It was just funny to hear them interact and really drive home the points and get the fans to, talk the fans into the building, as the old saying goes.
Yes, and the entire podcast that Steve and I are doing, they're still doing the individual cities, which is good. Princess Victoria and Velvet McIntyre defeat Wendy Richter and Peggy Lee. I don't mean to beat this point to the ground, but my goodness, Wendy Richter is still a heel.
And when she debuted, I think I recognized her from these matches. And, I think that's the same girl that was kind of like a heel wrestler maybe a few months ago. But she had such a nice look, like a kind of an athletic, kind of a sexy athletic look. It was very different than the old school, 78-year-old Moolah look. That was very an appealing improvement.
No, definitely. Wendy Richter looked like an athlete. She looked like a volleyball player, which is, not putting women from this era down, but not a lot of them, they lived on the road and they just didn't have the physiques. This is back when women typically did not weight train, and Wendy was weight training and she looked great.
Yeah, she was very toned and athletic.
Final match is Tony Atlas and Rocky Johnson successfully defending their tag team championships against Mr. Fuji and Tiger Chung Lee. Let's move on to All American Wrestling, and I'm going to try to get through an episode without trashing this. I mean, Big John Studd defeats SD Jones, Tito Santana defeats Rene Goulet, and then we go back in time. Tony Garea defeats the Wolfman in a match from 1975. Now, Steve, I liked seeing this match. I'll bet you liked seeing this match, but I just don't see the money in airing it. You should be highlighting the guys you want to push. And once again, this is USA Network. It's national cable.
Yeah, I got to be completely honest with you, and I thought I was watching wrestling every week in this time frame. I really don't remember them airing older matches like this. I do remember, I can recall on primetime wrestling, and maybe a couple of years later, I think I remember the one time they aired maybe an old Bruno match, maybe two times they did, but I don't remember this on All-American Wrestling. I will say, a few years later, and this is going probably around the era where where Bret Hart was the champion, and actually Johnny Polo, who became Raven, was producing the show. He brought back the nostalgia match, and he had like a Brody match and some other oddball matches that he would run. But I don't remember this at all from '84, any of the nostalgia matches.
I do remember that. All American Wrestling used to have a nostalgia match every week, and I had no idea that Scott Levy was the producer. Wow. And he was responsible for that. Wow.
He was in the, when the Bret Hart era, he was producing at that time when he was Johnny Polo and he was a manager, but here in '84, I can't remember these nostalgia matches at all.
No, I remember them. I don't specifically remember Gurria versus Wolfman, but I do remember they would air an occasional nostalgia match. As a matter of fact, we'll talk more about this as time goes on, but they would load up the Sunday night WTBS matches with them, which I absolutely love. This is towards the end of their WTBS run. Sunday night, WWF returns to the Hartford Civic Center. Terry Daniels defeats Jose Luis Rivera. Rene Goulet over Steve Lombardi. Tonga Kid fights Charlie Fulton to a draw. I can't wait until we talk about Tonga Kid later in 1984, but this is where he is now. Tito Santana defeats Pete Daugherty. I don't know if he was a sub or what, Steve.
Yeah, I think somebody must not have showed up, but Pete Daugherty definitely getting a special match against Tito Santana.
Yeah, and by the time this was announced, I mean, Tito had to have won the championship. Six-man tag, Piper, Orndorff, and Schultz over SD Jones, Tony Atlas, and Rocky Johnson. Once again, but here's something interesting. Bob Backlund defeats Iron Sheik via countout. Sergeant Slaughter was the guest referee for this bout. Wow.
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't recall that at all. Well, of course, it's a house show, so it didn't air. But yeah, this just goes to what we were just saying. It's such a unique matchup that maybe they didn't do in any other city.
And the WWF was unique because they didn't care if the ref screwed the heels. They didn't want a fair match. They just wanted the heels to get what they had coming to them.
Well, on the other opposite end of that, I liked it when they had the Fred Blassie referee a handful of matches with, I think it was Tito Santana against the Iron Sheik. And
yep.
Originally, Freddie called it right down the middle, but as the match moved on, he kind of showed his true colors and was pulling for the Sheik. So it was kind of funny to see.
I'm going to be honest with you. When I first saw that match, and I believe it aired on TNT, my 18 or 19 year old self was like, this is absolutely stupid. You know, just off the charts stupid. But as time has gone on, I'm able to laugh at the silliness of it. All right. Utica, New York. Shout out to our buddy Scott Cornish. Greg Valentine over Salvatore Bellomo. Chief J. Strongbow gets a win over Butcher Vachon. Oh, my God. That must be 110 years old between them. Richter and Peggy Lee over Princess Victoria and Velvet McIntyre. Tiger Chung Lee over Tony Gurria, Brian Blair over Ron Shaw, Jimmy Snuka over Samoan Sika, Ivan Putski defeats Samula, and the main event, Hulk Hogan defeats Afa the Samoan. Last conversation before we wrap this up. I've always wondered why, like when they go to a smaller town, like Utica, New York, like Manchester, New Hampshire, why they always had Hogan and Bob Backlund, I'm guessing Bruno Sammartino as well, defend against, at best, a B-level challenger. Like, I don't know, you know what, why not just have Hulk Hogan against Greg Valentine? They're both there, right?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I think for the most part, they did do exactly what you're saying. I think that they did have the champion face, whoever was the number one challenger at the time. I think what they were doing in this period, I do see that they had a TV match, which we just talked about, Hogan against, I think, Afa, one of the Samoans. And then they programmed that same match right around the same time period in some of the smaller venues like Utica. And I think what they may have been trying to do is just say, like, hey, you know, you just saw this match on TV, but, you know, it was an unresolved issue. You know, we're going to give off a rematch or something of that nature. And I think they even did that in Binghamton. I think around this time frame in my town, they had Hogan wrestle one of the Samoans on a card rather than have him wrestle, say, Orndorff or Valentine. I guess I can understand it. Just, like, give him a healthy win, like a big win over, you know, not a nobody, but you know, a tag team champion, and then have a decent card to go with it. I don't know really why they felt they needed to do that, but again, that goes back to that whole uniqueness idea. I do like the fact that they were changing up a little bit. Not every card had to be the exact same card, and they gave the fans in different markets different matches.
I mean, I can see that too. I mean, you know, the Samoans though are clearly, you know, the arrows pointed downward. They've lost the tag team titles. They've been around for well over a year now. I guess we always went out to see the WWF, not the individual wrestlers, not the individual matches, and there couldn't have been one person who thought that Afa was going to beat Hulk Hogan that bought a ticket for that but on that night. But doesn't that speak volumes? Yeah, they bought tickets. It doesn't give me an attendance, but I know the WWF generally did well in Western Central New York.
Yeah, as you've said so many times, the ability to see, you may not see Cal Ripken come to Utica, but you can see Hulk Hogan come, and you're coming to see all these stars, and whether he's facing Afa or if he's facing Orndorff, you're still seeing Hulk Hogan, really the number one guy in wrestling at that time. If you're a WWF guy, I'm sure if you're an NWA guy, you want to see Ric Flair in person. But it was a great night. I mean, I'm sure it was a great night to be in a WWF show with the world champion and all the other WWF characters and performers.
I can totally see that. I mean, like I said, you're going just to see the wrestling. I rarely did I go see, I'm going to go to this match because Hulk Hogan's on it or a specific wrestler's on it. Like, I wanted to see the promotion. But anyway, I've made that point before.
Well, that concludes the marathon of wrestling talk from the World Wrestling Federation of March 1984. We used to have two episodes-ish covering 3 months of the WWF. We've been doing that for a while, and now we've got three episodes covering 1 month. We are just about out of the footage that we recorded in 2021. We're going to keep going with this. The plan is to probably do, one show per month. Coming up in April and May, we'll have one episode of Stick to Wrestling dedicated to the WWF of that month. We used to do two episodes of 3 months, and now we're doing 10 minutes per average day of 1 month of 1984. So we won't have every detail under a microscope anymore, and I don't have to use every shred of audio I have. I have a lot more from 1984 than I did from 82, 83, etc. So with that, I want to thank Steve Generelli for all the great work he did co-hosting this episode. I want to thank Brian Last for giving us this forum with the Arcadian Vanguard Network. I want to thank Lou Kippelman for all the great work he does producing this show. And, of course, I want to thank every one of you for listening. It means a lot to me. Like I said last week, I was a little bit worried about this format coming in, and we've gotten all kinds of great feedback on it. So thank you very much. And with that said, this has been a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Go Vols, get to the Final Four.
This concludes our podcast day.